session number 12371, reel 14.
After that, we did carry out one or two operations further inland, mainly protective operations for the resupply aircraft that were flying in at that time. But then, of course, the weather clamped. And I personally have always maintained that this was one of the main reasons why Arnhem was a failure. I know that particularly the army have their own views, but I think that had the weather not have intervened as it did, not only would the resupply operations have been able to carry on, but I think it might have been possible to launch typhoon strikes against this armoured division that suddenly appeared out of the woods and that played such a devastating part in what eventually happened at Arnhem. This view is not only my own, but I think you will find it is a view that was also expressed by the Prime Minister, Winston Churchill. After Arnhem, my wing was directed to the continent to be redeployed. But before we went, we had one other rather futile operation that we had to carry out. And this again was in connection with the V2. I don't know the scientific reasons, but somebody had it in their head that it would be possible, possibly, to upset the directional control of the V2 by using a B-17 flying at 30,000 feet full of boffins, and they had equipment in there which they hoped would be able to upset the directional equipment that the Germans were using to control the V-2. Well, of course, these aircraft needed escorting, and for a short time, my wing spent their time flying backwards and forwards, protecting this B-17, which we didn't think was ever going to be attacked anyway. But fortunately, this lasted for a very short time because we then, as I said, redeployed to the continent. Now, if I might just explain very briefly the setup of the mobile wings that formed the tactical air forces in TAF, 2nd TAF. These really were mobile airfields. They were commanded by a group captain. They had the aircraft with their pilots and their squadron commanders, and they had a wing leader. And then there was a maintenance element, and there was an administrative element. They had their own air traffic control. And so they had virtually the same facilities as an ordinary permanent RAF station had, but the whole thing was mobile to the extent that it could be moved. One of the principles behind the mobile wing was that it didn't matter what sort of aircraft were put into that wing, the maintenance personnel were so skilled that they could maintain virtually any aircraft. This, of course, was a complete and utter mistake, and it showed itself up several times, because it was quite obvious that you couldn't expect to have maintenance personnel who were experts on the Merlin and on the Sabre, for example. When my wing went over to the continent, it was also a signal for 150 wing, that was Beaumont's wing, to move as well. So the only two Tempest wings were now moved over to Belgium. My wing went to Antwerp-Dern, where we became number 125 wing. And Beaumont's wing went to another airfield in North Belgium, Grimbergen, and became number 122 wing. While we were at Antwerp, we did one or two bomber escorts. These were mainly Lancasters that were operating, Lancasters and Halifaxes that were operating in daylight and attacking targets just north of Antwerp, Rotterdam, and odd places like that, which was still occupied by the Germans, of course. At the time we were in Antwerp, it was a rather unusual situation because we occupied one half of Antwerp and the Germans occupied the other half. And so one had to be very careful which streets one went down. And I remember on one occasion, there's a famous hotel in those days in Antwerp called the Century Hotel, which was the premier hotel in Antwerp. And my group captain, Scotty Malden, and I, the wing leader, were invited to this hotel one evening. And so we went along, dressed in our battle dress and armed to the teeth, and we were welcomed at the front door by the manager, who was in his pinstripe suit. And we went in, and it was just like an English pre-war seaside hotel. There was the Palm Court Orchestra playing and a number of people sitting round having their tea. The manager was being terribly polite and saying that he had two rooms reserved for us there, which were to be there at our convenience to be used any time we wished and there will be no charge. One had a haunting feeling that while the manager was welcoming us through the front door, his assistant was saying goodbye to the Germans out of the back door. That was the situation in Antwerp at that time. One saw some unpleasant sights. Something which we, of course, even now after four years of war, we hadn't experienced before. We saw a Jewish girl who was 9 months pregnant and had been left not only bound, but had had her legs bound together. Needless to say, she was dead.
This was in Antwerp.
Antwerp. On a lighter side, the White Army, which was the local resistance, had rounded up all the collaborators and had put many of them in the Antwerp Zoo in the cages. Needless to say, the animals had been taken out. And we went to visit them one day, And there were people in these caves, I mean, some of them were even in their evening dress, having been snatched in the middle of a party. On another occasion, my group captain and I were invited to a private house for some drinks. Now, one must understand that there was a great shortage of food, particularly in Belgium and Holland, or rather one had always accepted that there was a shortage of food. And it was clear that the ordinary man in the street was very hard pressed. Anyway, Scotty Morden and I went to this house. Of course, we didn't know anybody. And we stood sipping our drink that we'd been given, and there were quite a number of people around us, all chatting to one another. Nobody was taking much notice of us. After about a half an hour, Scotty said, "I think we'd better go." So I said, "Okay," but just at that moment, two big double doors opened, and powdered flunkies carrying trays laden with food came in and put it all out for a major supper. I mean, this was food that we hadn't even seen in England. Well, Scotty and I felt we'd better stay for a little bit longer, and I think we had a nibble at this and a nibble at that before we finally left. Two other interesting things to note during the short time we were at Antwerp was that we were bombarded every now and again by the Germans with anti-personnel bombs. These are nasty little weapons. They are essentially designed to either damage or destroy equipment with shrapnel, or of course to damage and destroy personnel. They make an indentation in the ground about the size of a dinner plate, and then the shrapnel has quite a wide spread. And if you get a number of these things fired, of course, they can be very damaging. And when you've got aircraft standing in the open, as we had, one could get quite a lot of aircraft damaged if one wasn't very careful. The other thing at Antwerp was we found a 109, an ME-109 in the hangar. And we had it in our minds that we might try and get this thing into flying condition, but we weren't there long enough to be able to do very much about it, and so we had to leave it there. The third thing I remember about Antwerp was that if you wanted a car, you just said to the White Army, "Can you get me a car?" And they just stopped the first car that came along, kicked the owner out, and would commandeer it. It was rather an unfair arrangement, and it's one that I hope not too many people profited out of. But I found that I'd inherited from my predecessor, the wing leader of a Spitfire wing, who had been 125 wing before we had come over to the continent and had gone off elsewhere. I'd inherited a big Buick saloon, and also a little sports car, the name of which I can't remember now. We hadn't been in Antwerp very long before we were redeployed to an airfield at Grave, Grave, which was the most forward airfield that we had at that time, and was not all that far from Nijmegen. Scotty went up by road with all the administrative personnel, and I eventually followed, leading the wing. When we arrived at Grave, it wasn't an airfield. It was just a field in which a strip of Sommerfeld tracking had been laid to form a runway. And again, everybody was accommodated in tents, except Scotty, who had his caravan, and myself, who was going to be accommodated in a farmhouse. But everybody else was going to be in tented accommodation. The airfield was below the level of the dike. In other words, we had a big dike wall running along one side of the airfield. And in fact, eventually it had to be abandoned because it flooded. We shared the airfield with Johnny Johnson's 126 Canadian wing. They were on the other side of the airfield from us. I arrived with the air party. We landed and we taxied in, and we got out of our Tempests. Scotty's caravan and his operations room vehicle were parked there, and the air traffic vehicle as well. And we were standing around talking. I was telling Scotty we'd had no problems on the way up, when all of a sudden there was a terrific banging and crashing and flames over at number 126 wing. And it was plainly obvious that Spitfires were on fire, and we could only assume at the distance we were at, which was quite some distance, that a Bowser had caught fire. Well, some minutes later, I can't remember quite how long after this episode, a Jeep came racing round and came up to us, and it was one of the Canadians from the Canadian wing, and he was in this Jeep with the roof up. And he drove up and he said, "Did you see that?" And we said, "Yes, what was it?" He said, "It was one of those bloody 262s, and it dropped a load of anti-personnel bombs on us." And he said that it had done considerable damage and there'd been some casualties. Well, I was standing by his Jeep at the time. As I say, it had the hood up. And it was a sunny day with a few cumulus clouds, when all of a sudden I heard a poof, and I looked up and I saw a big white cloud of smoke about 3,000, 2,000 feet above me. And I just idly said, "Oh, I wonder what that is." And this Canadian looked out from underneath the roof of his Jeep and he said, "Look out, that's one of them." And he leapt out and threw himself flat on his face. And we all did the same. All of a sudden, there was a whistling noise. And one really, I think, thought that this was the end. Well, these anti-personnel bombs dropped by these 262s were dropped in a canister, as I understand it, that then exploded at about 2,000 to 3,000 feet. And all these little bombs then came out and laid a carpet of approximately 50 to 100 yards across and 200 or 300 yards long. As I said, they're a weapon that were designed to really damage and destroy soft targets such as aircraft, personnel, petrobases, those sort of targets. Well, this whistling noise seemed interminable. It seemed to take ages for these things to arrive. They arrived, I might say, in with a lot of crackling, rather like fireworks. As I lay there, waiting for the end to come, I recalled my opening remarks to Scotty on arrival at Grave, and looking round and seeing what a flat and featureless area it was, I think the first thing we ought to do is to dig slit trenches. Of course, it was now a bit late. The crackling started to recede, and clearly the carpet of bombs was going in the opposite direction to where we were lying. And when we all realised we were still alive, we jumped to our feet, and the carpet of bombs ran right across our tented area, where at that time of day many airmen were getting ready to have their lunch. Obviously, the group captain decided he must go and find out what damage had been done and what the casualties were, and I decided to go with him. But just at that moment, a bulldozer, driven by an army sergeant, came along the top of the dike. So I sent an airman off to ask the sergeant to come down and speak to me, which he did. And I said to him, "Look, would you mind digging us a slit trench with your bulldozer just here by the side of these vehicles?" So he said he would. I then departed with the group captain to the tented area, where we found there had been a considerable number of casualties. Afterwards, I returned to where the operations vehicles were to find that the bulldozer had now left and that he dug a slit trench about 15 feet long and about 4 feet wide and about 12 feet deep, in the bottom of which was about 2 feet of water. If ever we jumped into that slit trench, if we hadn't drowned, we certainly would have never been able to get out again. These 262s, which were, of course, one of the first German jet aircraft, would come over at about 20,000 feet. So we couldn't hear them. And, of course, you couldn't really see them at that height when you were on the ground. And they then dropped these canisters of anti-personnel bombs, and so they would arrive in the way they had with us quite unexpectedly and would catch people very much on the hop. The aircraft itself, of course, had a very short endurance in those days, and as such had a fairly short range. Now, I referred earlier to the fact that these mobile wings were supposed to be able to accommodate any sort of aircraft, but the fallacy of this theory was shown up immediately when these two Tempest wings were called upon. The two wings, which were now Tempest wings, were called upon to accommodate Tempests instead of the Spitfires they previously had. The servicing personnel were quite unable to cope with the Tempest. It had an entirely different engine, and moreover, we were having difficulty in getting spares. And so after a while it was decided to merge the two Tempest wings together into one big 5-squadron wing. And so my two Tempest squadrons, number 274 and number 80 squadron, were taken from me and went over to Volkel, which was about 25 miles away, where Beaumont was presently situated with his 122 wing. And 122 wing now became the biggest wing in 2nd TAF. I, meanwhile, took over a Spitfire 14 wing, which moved into Grave to replace the Tempests. And here again, there's a little interesting story attached to this, because the wing leader of this particular wing was very well-known fighter pilot Geoffrey Page. Geoffrey Page had not only suffered severe burns at one stage of the war, but had also, I think, collected shrapnel from a cannon shell in his leg on the way up through Normandy. But here he was, still fighting on, and he was going to hand over his Spitfire wing to me. He came and shared my rather rudimentary accommodation in the kitchen of this farmhouse, where we both put our camp beds. And one late afternoon, he decided that he was going to take the wing on his final operation before returning to the United Kingdom and handing over to me. Now, Geoffrey Page was a highly experienced Spitfire pilot. And he went off on this operation. And when they came back, he circled the airfield, made the famous Spitfire curved approach, as he was about to come over the boundary fence, he straightened up to make the landing when the aircraft suddenly flipped over to the right, hit the ground and cartwheeled across the airfield. Now, to any observer, it looked as if Geoffrey had stalled the aircraft on the approach, which seemed inconceivable for somebody of his great experience on the aircraft. Fortunately, the Spitfire didn't catch fire. We rushed out, and we managed to pull Geoffrey out. He had banged his already badly scarred, burnt face on the gun sight, and clearly was suffering from concussion. Well, medical facilities were very limited with us, and I took Geoffrey back to our home in the farmhouse, where all night he was going on about how could he have been such an idiot and made such a ridiculous mistake to cause this accident. He was also being a bit sick as well. I wasn't at all sure that this accident had been caused by Geoffrey. I couldn't conceive that he could have made such an elementary mistake, but he somehow seemed to have it in his mind that he had.